Pickaxe.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to The Review of Death, your fortnightly home for Doctor Who news and reviews. I am Matthew Toffolo, and I am joined, as ever, by Billy Garrett-John, who should be over here in this window, if this is all gone correctly, if you're watching us on YouTube, of course, if you're watching us, or listening to us, rather, on Audacity. Audacity? You don't listen to us on Audacity. Sorry, my brain is frazzled. If you're listening to us on one of those audio podcast platforms, Spotify and all that shit, then it doesn't matter what we look like. How are you doing, Billy?
I'm good.
Haven't spoken yet.
I know, I'm good. I think we should, we're both a bit flustered because this is all obviously very new. And we're trying to figure out our way around this situation. My camera looks like shite compared to Matt's because my stuff hasn't arrived from the UK yet. My camera was in a big box and it's somewhere between Sydney and Auckland on a big ship.
Maybe it was caught in a time scoop.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
What are we talking about today?
I'm going to just, for socials, I'm just going to take a picture of you on the telly. Perfect. Beautiful. There we go.
That is quality audio content right there. Just for the socials, I'm going to take a photo of you. I hope everybody enjoyed listening to that.
My camera doesn't even go click either. So.
Oh, no, it hasn't got one of those manual old-fashioned.
No.
You should get one of those ones with a big flash bulb. The big explodey ones. At least
I have
would
to
hear
put
that.
A blanket over my head for, before I take it.
Time scoop. Nice reference. What are we talking about today? It's only one of the biggest episodes that we could possibly review in the canon of Doctor Who. It's only the Five Doctors, which we were going to do for episode 50, but then stuff kind of got shuffled around, and now we're finally here, episode 50, whatever it is, because, I don't know, Jinx Monsoon might be cast as the new Doctor Who between now and this episode going out.
I want to say 53?
Yeah, I guess three.
I think so.
Here we are, and it's everything is in a state of flux, folks. So if this isn't visually appealing to you, don't worry, it will get there. But audio listeners,
let us know what you think. In the comments, because I literally have just fannied around changing the view of this camera like 20 minutes before recording this. So if you think it looks like wank, let me know and I'll do something else with it.
I was hearing lots of swearing. What was it? Eat a dick? Was that the one?
Eat a dick, yeah. And you saw my arse looming.
I've seen your arse looming many times. The Five Doctors. And do you know what? I wasn't going in this review with any sort of trepidation. I wasn't going into it thinking, you know, it probably isn't going to be as good as I remember or whatever. I think I have come out of my screening of The Five Doctors. I was in the shed, had the heater going, had a little drink with me, and I was chilling out. And it was the first time I've watched Doctor Who since moving to New Zealand. And
wow, so how long has that been? A month?
It's
more?
Probably maybe like two, nearly 3 months without Doctor Who.
Jesus Christ!
Yeah, I know. But to be fair, we've had all the teasers and we've had all the, you know, location pics and stuff like that. So I haven't been totally, you know, going cold turkey.
I do like this image. You said I was watching Doctor Who in the shed. I have this image of Stella just saying to you, right, get out the house. I don't want to hear
She doesn't live on fucking Ramsey Street.
Sorry.
It's like, yeah, go away to your little shed and watch your Doctor Who.
We've come all this way to get away from that stuff.
Well, that's why it lives in here. It doesn't live in the house. It's not allowed in the house.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it is a comfort episode of mine, this story. And yeah. I think that's because it was one of the earliest VHSs I got. But like I said, I was going into this thinking, look, I'm going to really enjoy this because it's not been that long since I last watched it. It's been sort of maybe a year or two since I last saw it. And I came out of it going, I think this is one of my favourite Doctor Who's ever made. I think it is sort of top three, top five of all time. And
well,
yeah.
Funny you should say that, because in the DWM poll that's ongoing at the moment, which we will do, we'll do a big episode on
the
results of that whole thing eventually. But for the Fifth Doctor era, Five Doctors was voted the third best story.
So Caves was still number one.
And
Resurrection or Earthshock as number two?
Earthshock.
Good. Okay. Well, that's the right answer, DWM readers. Well done.
Yeah. I was quite surprised to see this at number three, though.
Do you know what? It's a bit like, I've got another Beatle analogy I'm going to make later, but it's a bit like everybody saying, well, the Beatles are the best band ever. And it's like, well, yeah. And it's like The Five Doctors is one of the best episodes of Doctor Who ever. And it's like, well, yeah. So I feel it sort of gets overlooked in a way. And it's an anniversary story, so it's one that everybody's seen 100 times and maybe takes for granted a little bit. But maybe it was the setting that I watched it in, the fact that I haven't watched Doctor Who for such a long time. And, I mean, it sounds like I'm starved of it and I haven't watched it for like 2 years. I've been locked in my shed, not able to watch it. But I think it was just the right storm of things and the right chemicals firing in my brain at that, during that day. I was just like, I need some Doctor Who. And The Five Doctors is what I needed to watch. And I came out of it just going, I think this is peerless Doctor Who, for many reasons. But I'm interested to get into it with you because I gather that I may be overinflating it compared to how you feel about it.
I mean, I guess, like you said, for you in the situation that you were in, it's good because this, I can't, what Doctor Who story do I watch? With which Doctor? Who gives a shit? I'll just watch this one. They're all in it, sort of. they're equally all in it and not all in it at the same time.
Indeed. And that's a lot to get into as well. My first question for you, Matt, is how did you first see The Five Doctors? Was it the broadcast? Was it the special edition? Was it Obelisk or Mr. Whippy?
I saw the broadcast version on VHS, the first version of the VHS that
came
out. The
85 release,
Yeah, not the later special edition one with the King's Demons. What about you? Was that the same as you? Did you see it the same way?
So my first exposure to this was the mid-90s special edition version. And then subsequently the DVD was one of the earlier DVDs I got because I think the DVD came out in 99 and that was the special edition version.
Yeah.
But Matt, I love my facts. I love my facts.
Yes.
Did you know that the version that you watched on VHS back in 1985, well, no, not back in 1985 because you hadn't been born yet, but that version, did you know you were actually watching the US version of The Five Doctors?
No.
Yes. So. What? There's a whole crazy production history with The Five Doctors. There's a whole history with the way it was eventually put out there on various forms of physical media in the future. So what you were watching was the US broadcast, which cuts about a minute. It basically just tops and tails the UK broadcast. And so it runs about a minute shorter. And that was the version that came out on VHS and Betamax in 85. I think that was the one that was that the one that was boxed with the King's Demons? Because the one that I got in the mid-90s version didn't come with the King's Demons. That was definitely a solo release, that one.
Oh, weird. See, I thought there was only one that came with the King's Demons.
Mm.
Maybe I'm getting confused. What was on your cover?
It's not the the Radio Times cover with the Black Obelisk. It's like, it's red from my memory.
Yeah, so that's the King's Demons
okay.
edition.
So I must have got it from a charity shop because I definitely didn't get the King's Demons with it because, you know, I'm not watching
the King's
Demons.
The charity shop got the King's Demons and thought, fuck, put that in the bin. No one's buying this.
Some poor kid ended up with the shit story out of that box set.
Yeah. Oh, this has got a cool robot man in it.
Or
oh, boy.
Somebody went, I hate the special edition version. I would rather keep the King's Demons and give the special edition version away. So,
oh,
yeah.
Maybe.
So you watched the broadcast version. I watched the special edition version.
Yep. I should point out that I watched The Five Doctors back when you were still in the country, because I thought we might have been able to sneak it in. So I've not seen it since, well, two, three months. Yeah.
Okay.
So you're going to have, I've got my notes. So it's like I'm reading another man's work.
Okay. Right. Well, look, I asked you the question, then we got bogged down in the particulars. Broadcast version or special edition, which one do you prefer?
I think probably broadcast, because that was the one that I watched as a kid. And obviously, the weird Mr. Whippy cone of doom.
Mm.
I don't like that. How did the poll go?
Okay,
I know
so...
You put it on Twitter.
We
I
did.
Obviously voted Obelisk.
Of course.
I think fans of a certain age voted for Obelisk.
Well, that's interesting, because I was certain it was going to be Black Obelisk all the way.
Yeah.
So the poll hasn't finished yet, but I think with, you know, nearly 600 votes, this is probably it now with 12 hours
wow.
left to go. Black Obelisk.
600 sad buggers.
Black Obelisk has beaten Mr. Whippy 56% to 44%.
Ooh, so it's close.
And for a while, they were neck and neck, and occasionally Mr. Whippy was pulling ahead. Now,
wow.
I think you're right. I think it is a generational thing. And obviously, it's down to whichever version that you were exposed to first. I was brought up with the special edition one, as I said, but I have to say I prefer the look of the obelisk, even though it's, you know, a 2D Quantel paint box rotating thing.
Yeah, I mean, both are equally shite.
Yes, let's be honest. And somebody else said this when they were commenting on Mr. Whippy versus Obelisk, and I was thinking this watching it. Do you think there's room for a special edition, maybe for the collection set when this comes out?
Oh my God. I mean, maybe. I think it was Tom Fan on Twitter who posted the picture of like a 3D obelisk which looked really, really cool. So I think maybe, but I mean, are we just delving into the realms of insanity?
Well, look, there's a reason the special edition exists, and that is because it is the only classic series story that retained all of its material, broadcast and unbroadcast, alternative takes, bloopers and all that sort of stuff, in
wow.
transmittable quality in broadcast standard.
Amazing.
And while it was broadcast in mono, it was actually recorded in four track stereo. So that's
where?
Why you get the 5.1 Dolby mix.
Yeah.
Which I have to say, I listened to with headphones, and even though I was watching it via totally legal means, because BritBox definitely exists out here, I thought it sounded fantastic. And that is definitely something I want to open with, as well as another bit of praise I want to heap on it. I think that this has one of the best scores in Doctor Who history.
It's amazing. It is so good.
It's the way it uses the Doctor Who theme elements, which we both love and that we don't get enough of because fuck Warner Chappell. It's everything.
And cleverly done as well. It's just those little ooey-oos just... They're ghostly and
the odd
and it
sort of
fits the
gung,
tone.
Gung, gung. And interesting, obviously, that they don't have access to the stems, the individual elements that make up the original Delia theme.
Yeah.
So that is everything being made electronically. All those dum-de-dums, you know, recreating the Delia elements by heart, which is fantastic.
Cyberman score. That's friggin' awesome as well.
Obviously, fantastic. Can I please get your best rendition of the Dark Tower?
Oh my god.
All right, let me have a go, and people can vote and say which one's better. Something like that. How's that?
I think yours was better.
Mine
sounded like a sheep being being run over by Bessie.
Castrated. How lovely was it? We'll talk about all the doctors respectively and their contributions to it, but when John pops up in Bessie. I just lit up because he looks great. I mean, his bouffant is blow dried to
its
ends. It's beautiful. What do you think of his costume? I understand that it's not a well liked Pertwee costume because you don't see the actual like suit underneath. It's just the cloak.
Yeah, I quite like it. I know people hate it, but I think because. Five Doctors was one of the earliest stories I ever saw. So it was, I knew no better. I just thought, well, this is one of his costumes, so who gives a shit? So I do quite like it. What I don't like is the weird gold, cummerbund that he's got that you only see occasionally. If you see the bit with the Rastan Warrior robot, when he runs into the cave to pick up the spears and stuff, his jacket comes undone. And he has some like gold foil cummerbund thing on. It's really weird.
Are we sure that's not that's just about. There to keep John's back straight? Is it not like
his
corset?
It might be. It could be his corset.
The
corset of Rassilon.
Okay, so we've got John in there. I think it's fair to say his contribution to it is great. Pat looks fantastic. His costume is perfect, no complaints there. He's wonderful in it. Peter Davison aside, who, although I'm not overly keen on his Doctor, on the Fifth Doctor, I think he's fine in this. He's a bit absent from the main, anniversary action because he's obviously on the A-tier story and the overarching sort of narrative with Barusa and whatnot. What do we think of the contributions of the two actors who weren't involved in this production, being William Hartnell and Tom Baker?
Well, I think William Hartnell has the best excuse because he was dead. So I think we can let him off as we have subsequently let him off for... I haven't let him off for Twice Upon a Time. I can't forgive him that. He should have come back for that just to turn around and say,
now.
I'm not doing this. Yeah, there's no excuse. I think Richard Herndl, I think, is fine. He is a bit too much of a miserable bastard.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have the twinkle that William Hartnell has. But I think in terms of the confines of this story, he works. I think I have less issue with him as the First Doctor than I do the First Doctor in Twice Upon a Time. Because at least the First Doctor in this is just crotchety and not a complete... he is a bit sexist, but he's not... Yeah. He's not sexist in the same way.
No, it's not his defining character trait. I think that the thing that shocked me the most in terms of discoveries of this is I think that the David Bradley First Doctor that we see in Twice Upon a Time it was written by Stephen Moffat because he's just watched The Five Doctors and thinks that that is what the First Doctor is like. Because
do you think?
You think, actually, when you go back, it's full of Arabs. That's not a great thing to say. But it's, that is one example of the First Doctor from his time played by William Hartnell. But the way that he's written in Twice Upon a Time is like the Herndl Doctor is in The Five Doctors. It's like a sort of very broad strokes approach because it can't be William Hartnell. And so what do you draw on? Well, he was a crotchety, grumpy old man from the 60s.
And you have that same thing, don't you, with the Fifth Doctor? He's a bit like, oh, God, I can't believe I used to be like this. Oh, Tegan, please, cut him some slack. I was a bit of a wanker back in those days,
For sure, for sure.
So, I can see what you're saying.
Thank God Tegan wasn't gay because,
Who,
maybe.
Well, Russell T Davies thinks so.
Well, there we go.
But it's up for debate with Janet Fielding. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, that because that would have been a whole other narrative to have gone down the Five Doctors. But thankfully, you know, that wasn't brought up.
Yeah. He also has the worst eyesight of any of the Doctors.
Hit me. What? Why?
Because when they're in the death zone, well, him and his granddaughter, because when they're in the death zone and they sit on that polystyrene rock, she's like, oh look, yeah, there's the TARDIS. And it's like, the TARDIS is literally a stone's throw away.
It's cataracts.
How did you not see that?
It's cataracts, obviously, yeah, Time Lord
and
Milky Ice
family.
In them.
Runs in the family.
It must
have got it.
That whole pairing is obviously right of yeah. Susan and the First Doctor. It kind of, besides the Fifth Doctor, obviously, kind of feels like the only pairing that they got right out of all of
yeah.
them. And that, you know, that sort of circumstance is out of their control. And, you know, I think that it was supposed to be the Third Doctor and the Brig together.
That would have been cool.
When Fraser wasn't available, because it was supposed to be Jamie and Zoe and the Second Doctor going through the Death Zone together,
right.
They had to swap yeah. things round. You know, it's kind of a miracle that this was ever made, considering the kind of
yeah.
plates they had to spin and the schedules they had to get right for everybody. And considering
yeah.
the fact that, as we were going to mention, there is another Doctor who is conspicuous by his absence, that being Thomas Bakerton. And
the real
yes,
Doctor.
The real Doctor who said that he didn't want to do it because the idea of being the feed for the other Doctors filled him with horror. So, you know, what do we think of the use of Sharda in this story?
I mean, given the fact that at that point no one had seen it, genius.
Mm-hmm.
It is actual genius. Fair play to J&T for coming up with that.
Big time.
Obviously now we have seen Sharda so many times, so it's not quite as clever. But I think, yeah, it's very well done. Fair play to him for making the best out of a bad situation.
Mm.
But can you imagine what that would have been like with Tom? He would have just run the show.
Yeah.
What would Peter Davison's Doctor have done? Because I know Terrence said he wanted Tom to be the Doctor that faced Barusa, because he thought that Tom was the Doctor more likely to sort of turn to the dark side, as it were. Because he's got that little dark twinkle, hasn't he, Tom? So what would Peter Davison have done? He'd have been stuck in the bloody TARDIS making drinks, cocktails,
and
feeding the First Doctor pineapple chunks.
You wee pussy like that. That would have been... Yeah, I mean, it would have been symptomatic of what a lot of his companions had to go through in the 80s in terms of the way they were used, being
yeah.
you know, locked in the TARDIS making yeah. tea and coffee. So maybe it would have been the perfect anniversary special if that had happened. It would have been the perfect in-joke. I have to say, you know, I don't want this to be another case of Billy bashes the, you know, Fifth Doctor for the sake of it.
Mm.
And maybe it's because he is in the presence of Doctors I prefer, but
yeah.
it does highlight the lack of, maybe not agency is the wrong word, but it does highlight the lack of authority that he exerts when he stood next
yeah.
to John and when he stood next
yeah.
to Pat. And I think that does irk me slightly, you know, that he is quite passive as a doctor.
Mm.
And I don't need my doctors to be barking orders and telling people to go and make tea and coffee. But, you know,
yeah.
out of all those doctors, if I was, whose journey would you prefer to have been on? You know, like, you would be there with John, surely, because
yeah.
he's the one that
yeah.
commands and he's the one that's in that position of authority and would keep
yeah.
you safe.
Yeah.
I think it did just highlight to me how much more passive he is
yeah.
as a doctor.
But even Pat manages, with the little that he has, he adds that twinkle to it.
Mm.
You know, and it, you know, those scenes are still a joy to watch with him and the Brigadier, you know, that banter and that's all that stuff. It's a shame, really. I mean, maybe Terrence just couldn't get a handle on his doctor. Maybe
yeah.
he's just like, well, you know, the other, like you said, the others have such strong personalities and such strong character traits that, yeah, maybe it was just like, well, I'll let him do the main story so that we can get the plot out of the way. Mm-hmm. But really, I want to do all the fun stuff with these two. And then
exactly. And it's because he knows them, you know, both professionally and privately. You know, and he was in the show and knows what they would be up to and what they would be doing. You know, he's more over those characters naturally. It again highlighted to me how Doctor Who is Terence Dix. Every line of dialogue, every reference, the techno babble, the fact that there isn't really a plot, but you just sort of just go along with it because it's a fun ride. The people's tone of voice, the pacing of it all, it just illustrates that Terence Dix, I think, is probably, besides the Target books, and, you know, obviously his contributions as script editor and for individual stories, his writing just is Doctor Who, and Doctor Who is him. And it was absolutely the right decision to get him to do it. I mean, Robert Holmes was initially approached. He wrote a spec called The Six Doctors. Which, if I find in my notes here, featured
the android.
William
Hartnell.
There's an android William Hartnell, and there's also a storyline about the Cybermen kidnapping past incarnations to create a new race, Matt, called, now stop me if you've heard this before, called the Cyberlords.
Oh, so, a much better name than the Cybermasters.
Indeed, but, you know, goes to show that maybe there is a filing cabinet in Cardiff that when people are running out of ideas, they just go through old specs from the 80s and go, maybe the Cyberlords would be an interesting thing to do.
Yeah. Oh, shit, we better change the name.
At least, yeah, so we don't get in trouble with Bob's own estate.
Is that copying the homework?
It is, yeah. Just tweak it slightly.
Just a little bit.
That was an intention. Waris Hussein was also going to direct this story. Who did direct this in the end?
Peter Moffat.
Okay. Probably his best Doctor Who?
I like State of Decay. I think he does
State
a good
of Decay
job
is
State
good.
Of Decay.
That's true. That's true.
I can't forgive him with that. I think the trouble is, I can't forgive Peter Moffat for that Sarah Jane Smith falling down that slight incline.
Oh my God.
Because that is just appalling. And obviously JNT directed the amazing Cyberman Raston Warrior Robot seat.
Yeah. So, I'd forgotten about that.
You know, JNT, man, he should have done some more stuff because that's one of the best action sequences in at least classic Doctor Who, possibly
Absolutely.
In all Doctor Who.
He knows that, you know, ultimately all people want to see is Cybermen being decapitated and spewing out Remy's milk. That's ultimately what they want. Apparently Waris Hussein was approached, and I was able to ask him about that last year, and he was in America at the time, so he wouldn't have been able to do it anyway. And Douglas Camfield was approached and then declined, and then would subsequently pass away at the start of the next year, very early in 84. But Peter Moffat does do a good job with this story. And, you know, you've got to think, again, how many plates they were spinning. Probably trying to wrangle those egos in the studio as well when you finally get all those doctors together.
I was just going to say, you know, he's got a lot of people to try and keep happy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, I think there is studio footage, isn't there, where you can see John gets a bit testy and, you know, it must be difficult. You know, if you'd have had Tom in there as well, you know, there probably would have been a punch up or something.
Nothing would have been done. They would have, everybody would have gone on strike. Sarah Jane being pulled out of that ditch. I mean, Elizabeth Sladen has her working boots on to try and sell that. And she, you know, she kind of does, but you can't distract yourself from the fact that she is just in a lay-by, you know, like she is on a very slight incline. But all that is forgiven when you see John in his full splendor, and there's a sort of Vaseline smeared quality to all the location footage. It looks so luscious, and his hair looks so luscious, and it all just looks fantastic. And I just lit up seeing him, and I just thought, I can forgive the daftness of Sarah Jane falling into that slight ditch. This is just
John stole the line from Liz Sladen. the teeth and curls line. She was supposed to say that. She was supposed to say, last time I saw you, you were all teeth and curls.
Does any of that surprise me? No, not in the slightest. You know, I think
it doesn't really make any sense, because why would John Pertwee know what his future regeneration looks like?
Big Finish Audios exist.
I was just about to say there must be a Big Finish box set.
Of course.
Explaining how that happens.
We might go into this when we do our Patreon review of The Artist at the End of Time, which has just come out. But, you know.
Is that out?
Yeah. I mean, it's come out for me because it's the 1st of June. As I record this in NZ.
Oh, wow. So you have it ahead of me.
Yeah, exactly. So I might try and listen to that today and get my notes done. But when we come to do the Patreon one, we'll talk about that more in depth. But it's a bit of breaking news. When I woke up, Big Finish have removed the AI version of the cover. Very quickly, because we want you to, you know, actually, you know, listen to the Patreon version and tell us what you think. What do we think of them bowing down to all that criticism?
I mean, I didn't think there was a problem with the cover, really. I mean, it's being used as a tool to create new things, you know, like the robots.
No, it's not being used to destabilize governments, so it's all right.
Exactly. But I do think the current cover is better.
It is less cluttered.
It looks less cluttered. It's just nicer, I think. Just a nicer cover. So, fair play to them.
If you want to know more about our thoughts, then you can head over to patreon.com/thereviewofdeath and you can listen to not only our review of Doctor Who Once and Future Past Lives, but also all the other Once and Futures and our other audio dramas that we're listening to.
That Sylvester McCoy one looks good, doesn't it?
It does. A Genius for War, Terry Malloy's back and all that kind of stuff. It's, very exciting. On the subject of John still, because I can't get enough of him, there's actually more of a praise of another individual in this who I think is superb and who I appreciate more every time I see him. I would have probably said a few years ago that I was disappointed that it's not Delgado and Pertwee sparring off against each other in the Death Zone. But you know what? I have grown to love the Ainley Master so much over the last year plus that I don't care. I'm not disappointed.
No. It works really well, that scene.
It's just brilliant because, of course, the Doctor is suspicious of the Master and you don't get the impression that this is a different person, you know, the way that they're interacting. What do we think of Anthony Ainley in this story? I think this is one of his best performances. I absolutely love him.
He's great, and you do sort of feel sorry for him because you think, you know, he has every right to be pissed off at the end.
Totally.
Because he really does, you know, he was trying to help them. I mean, I think he's great. I mean, I that scene with him and John is fantastic. The scene in the council chamber with the president and Flavia and Castellan, you know, that's great as well. He's just got that wonderful twinkle in his eyes. It's just mischievous, isn't it? He's got that mischievous twinkle. He's great. He's ever so good.
What makes you think I want your forgiveness? He's just like, he just radiates. He doesn't radiate sort of cruelty. He doesn't radiate like black evil, you know, like deep evil. He's just a meddler, and he just revels in things going wrong and things only going his way, and you know he's camp in the best kind of example of a Doctor Who villain being over the top but also still menacing, and you don't want to get on the wrong side of them, you know.
And he looks amazing in that cloak.
He does.
He looks great.
He should have kept that.
He should have kept that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so good.
He teams up with the Cybermen because he's had enough of people assuming that he's a wrong one in this situation. But of course, we know he is.
He thinks to himself, I've never teamed up with the Cybermen before. And then subsequently, Stephen Moffat goes, the Master always teams up with the Cybermen.
Always.
Got it.
Again, maybe the only episode of Doctor Who Stephen Moffat's ever watched is The Five Doctors.
It does seem like
maybe this goes to prove that point.
And all of the bits from Name of the Doctor. Pat Troughton, Five Doctors. John Pertwee, Five Doctors.
It's we've broken this conspiracy wide open. Yeah. Absolutely. The Cybermen are in it. It's my favourite iteration of the Cybermen. It's the 80s Cybermen. It's David Banks. It's Mark Hardy. It's the whole gang back together. But what is wrong with their voices on location? They sound terrible.
They sound weird. Yeah. Like they sound bonkers.
Slightly it does. They sound like Mulligan and O'Hare.
Mulligan and O'Hare.
It's just, it's so bad. But when they get into the studio and it sounds better.
It's
I guess it's just radio interference or somebody didn't know the
Welsh
settings. Welsh weather. It makes everybody sound a bit more high-pitched when it's cold. You know, their little cyber bollocks are freezing. I'm not surprised they're a little bit higher-pitched.
Yeah, David Banks... it just sounds weird.
And then Mark Hardy is always the slightly higher one anyway, and then he starts to sound a bit like this, and it's like, it just sounds crap.
What do you think of the R? Oh, no, you didn't get the R because
we didn't get the R.
The broadcast,
no.
The special edition, yeah.
I tell you one thing.
I like the R.
I like the R as well. Is that the Doctor Who equivalent of no from Star Wars?
Yeah, it must be.
It must be. What do you think, the one thing that I did notice, because, you know, I'm so used to watching the special edition that I, you know, one thing I did notice is that Tom's final scene in it that they use from Sharda isn't running into the TARDIS and getting his scarf stuck in the door. It's just the Mr. Whippy dropping him off back on top of the punt boat and flying off.
Oh, really? How weird.
Yeah. And that is definitely something from the special edition that I don't prefer.
No. I like that. When I was a kid, I thought that was the best, Tom running into the TARDIS.
It is. And it's just, it's a bit more action, you know?
Like, yeah.
I guess in context, it doesn't really make an awful lot of sense because he's not being dropped off exactly where he's, you know, supposed to be and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it is what it is.
Who gives a shit? It's the end of the episode. People are just glad to see Tom Baker doing stuff that they've never seen before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're all happy with Tom's contribution because, you know, things didn't kick off in the studio. Other monsters that pop up in this, obviously, you've got the Cybermen, you've got the Dalek, which, you know, the Dalek contribution is a bit disappointing. It seems to me it's been written by somebody who couldn't care less whether or not the Daleks are in it. I'm just like, well, it's the 20th, so we've got to have them in it somewhere.
You see Terrence Dix, they think, oh, bollocks, we've got to have the Daleks in this. Oh, in a corridor, laser beams bounce off the mirrors.
Yes, yes. he's very excited about having the Daleks in there, obviously. But we do have the Yeti.
I will say though about that Dalek sequence, we do get that amazing shot of the Dalek exploding and all of the innards. So I can forgive it for that, and also that amazing outtake from Roy Skelton
where bollocks.
He goes bollocks.
Yeah, that's lovely. I think maybe it's because it's Peter Moffat directing, and maybe they needed somebody a bit more dynamic and somebody who would have shot it a bit less static. Kind of like, but yeah. I think that shot of the Dalek exploding would have looked better in motion or with somebody in the foreground, because it looks like somebody has set up an explosion and everybody's too scared to get near it, because the Dalek has got all of its gun sticks down and it's obviously just, you know, I think
an empty prop.
Something, or the cut needs to be a lot quicker to get to that explosion or something, but it, you know, that is a peanut sort of complaint from me, so, you know, whatever.
Is that one of the worst Daleks in history?
Can we think of worse Daleks than that?
There's probably a couple from the chase, like the one that gets pushed off the Mary Celeste. He's obviously hopeless.
That's pretty bad. I can't think of many other bad Daleks. I think he's the worst. He's probably the worst Dalek.
He's pretty awful, isn't he?
Yeah. He's coming at the bottom of Davros's Christmas list for sure. That's poor form from that Dalek. The Yeti sequence I really like.
Yeah. That's really cool.
A bit like the whole thing with Jaws and the fact that the mechanical shark didn't work, so they had to shoot around it. Apparently the Yeti was in an absolute state, that costume. So that's why they leave a lot of it to darkness and a lot of it to close sort of close shots.
But it works. It works so well.
It really works.
It's better for it.
Totally. One thing that doesn't work, though, is the second Doctor and the Brigadier getting cornered in a little cave and going, well, this is it, we're dead. Bruh, there is clearly daylight behind you.
I know,
You know, like, and then all they do is sort of turn around and go, where there's a wind, there's a way. It's like, Pat, come on. There is clearly a massive way for you to get out of here that you guys are having to ignore. But yeah, that whole thing, the galactic glitter is nice. But it's like, but I think that's left over from John, because it doesn't, you know, sure, Pat's got very baggy pockets, but he's not the gadget doctor.
But it's just a firework, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a little sprinkler.
Every time I watch that, I just think, oh my God, health and safety. They just said to Pat Troughton, here, light this firework, Pat, and make sure you toss it. Make sure you toss it before it blows up and takes your hand off.
At least he's not doing a Matthew Waterhouse and sort of like squinting and like holding it like as far away from his face as he can possibly get it.
Fair play to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Nick Courtney's has got a bit more trepidation about carrying the torch in those caves. I think he's a bit like, shit, I've got spirit gum attached to my face.
I'm going to go up in flames. I'm going to come out of this cave looking like Bilal. I'm going to have everything singed off. He's great in this, though. He's, you know, it is interesting seeing this blend of actors from different generations, though. I'm not, you know, trying to use this as a sort of an underhanded comment on anybody, but, you know, Carol Ann Ford is acting in a very 60s Doctor Who fashion. You know, she's been given arguably even less to work with than she was when she was on the show initially. She's sort of absent character wise. You know, this could be anybody.
Now, we're on the subject of Susan.
Mm.
Obviously, one of the biggest missed opportunities here is that her and the Fifth Doctor don't get to have a conversation. But of course, this is 1980s Doctor Who. This isn't modern Doctor Who, where this would definitely happen. You know, that was just the way things were back then. But when Susan sees the Fifth Doctor, she always looks at him with a look that says, oh, he is a bit all right.
Do you know what's hilarious about that? I discovered that John Nathan Turner kept saying to Carol Ann Ford, can you stop calling him grandfather? Because it insinuates that at some point in the past, the Doctor has had sex.
Right.
And she was like, apparently she just laughed in his face and said, well, I'm not going to do it then, if I can't call him grandfather. So it's funny that you say that. So maybe is she sort of taking the piss by doing that?
Maybe she is. Maybe she thought, I'll get you, John Nathan Turner.
I'll look at him like I want to ravage him on the spot and, you know, get your cricket whites off, mate.
She does a bit. And I always thought it, like, even as a kid, I always thought, that's a weird way to look at your granddad. I mean,
do me now on Rassilon's altar.
Oh, my
grandfather.
Jesus Christ.
God, or grandson. You're young enough to be my, you know, at this stage. Okay, so we're in the tower of Rassilon. We're in the Dark Tower. The chessboard.
Oh wait, what about the Rassilon warrior robot? We haven't really talked about that.
Oh, well, it's obviously one of the best scenes in Doctor Who. It's just it's amazing. And
Terence Dix loved it so much that bloody robot comes back in so many novels.
Yeah, right. It's had a life of its own.
It's always turning up.
It's I mean, I'm amazed it took as long as it did for us to get an action figure of the Rassilon warrior robot. But now that we have it, that's obviously fabulous. And it's just a brilliant scene, and the right Doctor as well to have, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's action oriented and it's, you know, it's very of Pertwee's time to have a sequence like that. Something else that I think that Terence loved, because again, I think he's brought it back here, is the killer floor from Death to the Daleks, because we have the chessboard, which is an exercise in, all right, we need to stop these characters from getting to the tomb of Rassilon as quickly as the story maybe necessitates. So let's just put the brakes on a second here. What do you think of the chessboard? Is it daft? Does it go on a bit too long?
See, it's fine. Like, it's fine until they try to work it out. So, like, when you see the Cybermen going across it, getting zapped, brilliant. You know, they're blowing up all over the place. It looks amazing. As soon as you start talking about pie and all this shit, you're like, well, how does that relate to this in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah.
And then you have Anthony Ainley, like, hopscotching across it. And so you sort of think to yourself, oh, okay, maybe certain tiles are dodgy. And then you get Richard Herndon, who just literally walks across the floor as if nothing is wrong with it whatsoever.
But doesn't the Ainley Master, or is this some sort of misdirection? He says to the cyber leader, the pattern must change with every crossing.
Oh, I think that's just misdirection.
Okay, fine. Right. Okay, that does make sense.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
It does feel like the entire story puts the brakes on, though. And
it does.
You know, it's the bit where it does. It's the only part of it, I think, that feels laboured, considering that the special edition is an hour 40, which is, you know, movie length plus. It's the only part of it, I think, that feels like they really could have trimmed that. Because also it's not, this will tie into my kind of conclusion on the story, but I don't care how long this is, because you get to spend more time with these characters and you get to see them interact and all that good stuff. But that sequence, when it's the pairing that makes the kind of least sense, when it's Tegan and the First Doctor, it's like, right, let's just get this thing out of the way, you know? Like, they could have just cut the bit where they eventually cross and it's just like, oh, they just got... Maybe they walked around the edge, because I think that you probably could, you know?
You probably could, yeah. I mean, I think the problem with that is, up until that point, everything else in the Tomb of Rassilon, like in the corridors, is all moodily lit. You've got all those sort of coloured gels on the walls and stuff to light it. But then you get to this and it's just an open space, brightly lit studio.
Yeah.
It's like, well, there's nothing here other than some, like, buttresses or pillars or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then this floor that makes no sense.
No.
And you can just tell, like, oh, this is a nightmare because we've got all these pyrotechnics to go off and, you know, we just need to get this done. So there's not really any flair in how that's directed, that scene. So yeah, I agree. It just feels like you just sort of go, oof, okay.
And you're right with, you know, the fact you're cutting away from the moody, creepy atmosphere of the corridors.
Yeah. because you've got all that stuff with John.
Exactly. And you're getting the anniversary pops. You're getting the kind of the Marvel style, it's that character that's come back, you know. And like when Jamie and Zoe appear, you can almost paste the whooping and hollering of a Marvel cinema audience over their appearance, because it is just the reveal where you just have the Second Doctor and the Brig walking down the corridor and then the kind of reaction of what they've seen, and then you cut to them. And we've already, at this point, have we already seen Mike and Liz Shaw, and we know that things are a bit spooky?
We have.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that John probably went, why isn't Katie here? But it's lovely to have Liz Shaw, because she is... You know, she gets a year on Doctor Who and then is forgotten about for the rest of eternity.
Yeah.
So it's lovely that, you know...
She gets to help come back. And
exactly, that Caroline John is there.
Yeah.
Do you know who was also supposed to be in this?
John Levine?
Yes. Do you know why he's not in it?
They didn't give him enough to do.
Living with Levine is one of the most amazing documentaries I think the Doctor Who's ever made, because it does give you an insight into the man. And it does, you know, it does make you question if the lights are on. Because he did apparently say he was offered the part that Colonel Crichton eventually plays.
Okay.
So he's supposed to be the Briggs successor in that scene, that first scene with the second Doctor.
But I can't believe that Sergeant Benson would get there.
But who else do you have? Because you can't give it to Yates, because he's going to turn heel and become a baddie at some point again.
Oh, yeah.
He'll get turned over to the dark side.
Yeah, he's got the sack.
It's like making Ringo the lead of the Beatles, Benson the head position in unit.
Yeah.
It's just like, what are you doing? So apparently he was given the script and said, you're going to be the Briggs replacement. And because the script required him to not recognise the second Doctor, he said, I'm not going to do it, and just pulled out. And it's just like...
What?
But that's an oversight on Terence's part, obviously. He obviously forgot that Benson had met the second Doctor. But why wouldn't you just say, can we just tweak that
tweak this scene, yeah.
You know, like, I guess the scene kind of revolves around the fact that the second Doctor is dismissive of Crichton and is only there for the Brig and blah, blah, blah. But you idiot. Why? You could have been in, you could have been in the 20th anniversary special.
Wow.
That's so daft.
I like to think that what actually happened was, right, John, you have to be Alistair Gordon Etheridge-Stewart's successor. And because at UNIT, if you're in a position of authority, you have to have a moustache. So you have to grow a moustache for this filming. And he thought, shit, I can't grow a moustache. Not going to do it.
And Nick's not letting you borrow a spirit gun because he's only got so much of it left. You know, it's not going to happen.
We've only got the budget for one moustache.
For one moustache. We've spent it all on getting these other actors back and flying everybody in from all over the place. Yeah. You can only have one moustache. That's it. Maybe that's the money that was fronted by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, because that's a co-production with them. So maybe they put the money in for the syrups and the moustaches. So we've got all that great spooky stuff in the corridors, and then we eventually get to the Tomb of Rassilon. And it's here where we confront the main villain of the story. It's not the Cybermen, it's not the Daleks, it's not the Yeti, it's not Peter Moffat. It is Barusa.
That was my horny reveal.
as we've said before on the Review of Death, most good Doctor Who stories live and or die on a good villain, on the good baddie. And the Master is sort of secondary to all this. He's on the same level of participation as the Daleks and the Cybermen. He's in it more, but, and he obviously moves the story along with his involvement with the High Council and whatnot. What do we think of Barusa as the main villain for this story?
I think that was a really clever idea on Terence's part, because it is a character that we've got to know quite well over the subsequent appearances. I think initially the plan was it was going to be the Master. And like he said, well, people are going to see that coming a mile off. So I think it's clever to have someone that the Doctor, admired turn out to be the bad guy. This sort of idea that, he's been in power so long that you do get a bit power hungry and, it corrupts you and you want to... he wants to cling to that. So I think that was good. And I think the actor playing him is really good.
Yes, I forgot to look that up. But yeah, he power corrupts. You're absolutely right. That is his problem.
Yeah.
And you buy it. Like, I buy that he is drunk with power. That whole thing of, I've still got work to do. I haven't finished yet. And his final thing is to be granted immortality. And obviously, it's that old fable. It's Terence going back into the well of, myths and legends and stuff. Like, you don't want this immortality thing. Yeah. It's a curse. And
to lose is to win, and he who wins shall lose.
The inclusion of Rassilon. And I love...
Yeah.
I think that death, everlasting life... thing
it's so creepy.
Barusa. It is horrible. It's
those
just
eyes going. It's horrible.
It's awful. I think there's some studio footage I've seen somewhere of the retakes and retakes of all those poor actors sort of sitting there going
doing that.
Left
yeah.
and right, and you say, "Oh God, the eye strain already on me is getting too much."
An often quoted line in our house is, "Hang on,
yeah."
on the ring.
What do we think of Rassilon? Because this is Rassilon's, you know, he's here. We're seeing Rassilon.
They've modulated his voice, haven't they, in the special edition?
Yeah, he sounds a bit more ominous, yeah.
So he's all immortality. I mean, yeah, sure. He's great. I think he makes his first appearance proper in Doctor Who Weekly, I think, or Doctor Who Monthly at that point. I think he's in the comic strip first. But yeah, for his first TV appearance, yeah, what? Fine. He's a big Ed.
He's a big Ed.
He's a big Ed.
Time Lord Society, I think, is at its peak of representation in the Five Doctors, because it's, you know, it's not the old fuddy-duddies wandering around moaning about their hips. It's not the sort of Phantom Menace levels of, why are we talking about bloody, you know, political relationships and da-da-da-da. It's not long, empty corridors, and then suddenly they're sat down having a coffee like it is in the Ark of Infinity.
Ark of Infinity,
But Time Lord history and Time Lord society feels lofty, and it's like we're seeing Rassilon and, you know, all this sort of stuff. It does. I think it does. It is paid off well, all this, you know, building up of the mythology of Time Lord society. I think it's really well represented in this. And I love the, can I grant you immortality, doctors? And they're all, no, thanks. And Pat hiding behind John is just beautiful. That's obviously a pattern.
And then he says, joke's on you, you're going to be immortal anyway. You're going to have all these regenerations.
Yeah, I haven't told you yet, but I've looked into the mists of time, and there's going to be lots of really convoluted ways in which you get your regeneration cycle refreshed. So don't worry. I think that's one of my favourite little bits of acting from Pat, is him cowering behind John. And it goes to show that although there may have been a bit of tension initially, that they do have a chemistry on screen together. And sometimes it is that sort of those combustible elements coming together that does generate the best performance out of two actors. And, you know, you see so many examples of that, but they're great together. And I love that moment.
And I also like the fact that it's the Hartnell Doctor that sort of gets it and twigs to it, and that, you know, there's that wisdom to it.
Yeah.
Even though technically he's youngest out of all of them, he has that wisdom that they all sort of respect, which I like.
It's a lovely touch, and it's the most useful he's been in this story, really, because he can't be as physically involved. So of course he's got that, you know, he's got that older/younger head on him, and he's able to dictate things. It was great. I think though that final coming together of all the companions and doctors and stuff in the grander scheme of the story feels very fleeting, you know.
It does, it's very rushed, isn't it?
It does feel right, you know. It's lovely to see the Brig and Sarah Jane back together again, but it does feel like, okay, we're running out of time now, we need to sort of get on with this. I think that's the only disappointing part of it.
Yeah, and I like that it's the Brigadier is sort of the one that cements them all together.
Yeah.
Because he's seen them all. He's seen all the doctors, and with the exception of Susan, he's met all the companions.
And there's Susan sort of in the corner going,
yeah,
you know, like, I don't know anybody here. It's like going to a party and not knowing everybody. It's just like, this is awkward.
Oh, this is awkward. And I kind of fancy my granddad.
Fucking hell. Okay. But that ending, that final line, it's like, you know, it is a circular thing, and it all comes back together. It's like having Hartnell at the start again. It's just, it's topped and tailed beautifully with that.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to go on the run from your people in a rickety old TARDIS, you know, and that is just such a lovely final line to end on.
It is beautiful. Now, remind me, when the TARDISes leave the Tomb of Rassilon, how does that look in the special edition?
Do you know what? This is good. This is terrible. I can look at it now, but do you know what I did, Matt? I actually only watched, like, I don't know, I probably missed the last 10 minutes, because I'm like, I know how this ends. We all know how this ends. To my mind, it doesn't look all that dissimilar to the regular version.
Because it's very clunky. That sort of rotoscoped image of the TARDIS going...
warping out. I'm actually just on my highly legal version of being able to... Oh, okay. So, the Mr. Whippy ice cream cone merges outside of the police box and then picks them all up so the TARDIS doesn't sort of float off. Which probably does look better.
It probably does look better. And probably makes a bit more sense. But like you said, ending beautifully with that line, why not? After all, that's how it started. Brilliant, lovely stuff. And like you said, the story is bookended that way because we have Hartnell at the beginning, which is a really lovely way of getting Hartnell in it.
Exactly, I'm
really glad that they did that. It must have been incredible for fans at the time who hadn't seen Sixties Doctor Who to see, the governor himself.
The original, you might say.
Right at the start. Yeah, they must have been like, holy shit, that's him. That's him from the old days.
I think that it's a complete anniversary special, I think, because of the fact that they went to the lengths of thinking, let's get an archive clip. Let's go into Time Lord mythology. Let's have all these actors come back together. Let's get all these old monsters back. And yet still give something to the new lot to do, and still be part of the story. And it's what I came back to when I did finish it. I say finished it, obviously I didn't finish the entire story. But it's the thing that I came back to at the end, and with the use of the Delia theme going into the modern version of the theme.
Yeah, really cool.
It's the template for all Doctor Who anniversary stories. Doing that is the reason that the 50th anniversary opens with the Hartnell title sequence. And that we have the, obviously the three Doctors did it first, but that wasn't technically an anniversary special. It was just the first episode of season 10. It sets the pace for what we expect from a Marvel style team up anniversary story. And I think that is another reason why it's overlooked. Okay, there's one fault which I can pick with it, which I'll put to you in a minute. But I think this is perfect. I don't think, even the special edition. I think this is one of the best episodes of Doctor Who ever. What do you think? Do you think that's hyperbole? Do you think it's maybe not as good as it's made out to be? Or,
I mean, it's jolly good fun, isn't it? I mean, I don't think you can watch it and not have a smile on your face throughout. I think maybe when I was younger and I was in my arsehole teenager days, I probably would have said, oh, it's a bit fan wanky. But honestly, bollocks to that. It's great. It's great fun. Is it one of the best episodes of Doctor Who ever? I don't know if I'd go that far. I wouldn't put it in my top 10, for instance. But I think it is a perfect distillation of everything that is Doctor Who. There's a bit of something for everyone in it. And, it honours the past while moving the story forward. So, like you said, the stuff with Time Lord mythology is great because we get to build upon Rassilon and his character. And was he good or was he bad, And that whole dilemma of like, well, is he a bit shady? Which obviously, inspires Timothy Dalton and Donald Sumter when they come to play the part, and how he's presented in the Time War and all that sort of stuff. It's great. It's really good fun, and I don't think, given the circumstances, I don't think this story could be any better than what it is.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's when you, that's totally right. When you include the technical and logistical, things that they must have had to have gone through to get this off the ground, let alone finish it and get it as good as it is. It's kind of a triumph, really. And I'm sure that I can't imagine that there was any Doctor Who fan. I mean, obviously we've got lots of people watching who would have seen it on broadcast. And would have been, you know, paying attention to all the hype and all the build up through the Radio Times and with the Doctor Who exhibition at Longleat and so on. And, you know, would have known. Oh, no, hang on. Longleat is 85? It's not. Or is it 80? Is it 83?
It's 83.
It is 83. Obviously, everybody who was watching it at the time may have a different feeling about it and their opinions may have changed. But I cannot imagine how exciting it must have been at the time. So, you know, when you include that and the fact that it still gets me, it's every single time that these actors come together, it's still exciting and I'm never bored watching it. And I think that is the thing. If I was to criticize it for anything, it still doesn't even turn into a criticism, because the only thing I can say about it is it too long? And certainly the special edition. But then I also have to ask, and here's the other Beatle analogy, does the White Album have too many songs on it? You know, like, you're spending all this time with these people, with these characters. It's the same thing I feel about Colin when we watched Trial of a Time Lord for the Pandorica talk we did. I am now sad that this season has come to an end and that this is the last you see in the original series of this Doctor. When the Five Doctors ends, it's like, I wish I could see more of these people interacting, these characters interacting and all this sort of stuff. It is the Marvel team up. It's the original. And I think it gets all of that stuff bang on for what they were losing with Tom and obviously William Hartnell not being involved. And then other actors who could have, you know, been part of the celebrations but couldn't for logistical reasons. I just think that it all just comes together to form this perfect little nugget of Doctor Who. You're right, it is distilled quintessential Doctor Who, and I think that's probably why it's one of my favourites of all time.
Yeah, it's magical because it manages to be equally brilliant in the way that certain things are shot, like we've said about the action sequence with the Cybermen and stuff like that, and also equally managed to be a bit shit in places with stuff like, you know, the Dalek or Liz Sladen down a hill.
Or the fact there isn't really a plot. It's just, you know, let's just walk up this big hill for an hour and a half to get to this big room, you know.
We'll get to the castle and see what happens. It is very much like that. A few other things that we should probably mention about this story. Notable first, new TARDIS console room.
I had that written down. Oh my God. I think it would be my favourite if it had more levers and dials on it, but I just don't like the fact that it's that kind of really 80s, let's get a load keyboards of BBC micros and stick it on there. Yeah. You know?
I mean, I love that TARDIS. I mean, my brother loves that TARDIS. But yeah, it's great. And a nice introduction, you know, Peter giving it a little polish.
The Doctor's got a little present. You know, he's got himself, because it's his 20th anniversary, he's got himself a new console room and, you know, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, thank you very much for the extra money, because we've been able to afford this. I think I'm used now to having a big column, a big rotor in the TARDIS. So it does feel a bit squashed and squat now, those classic console rooms. But yeah, it's a beautiful bit of design. And I noticed that the Whoseum may be constructing a new one of their own. So get over on Instagram and look at the Whoseum if you want to feel insanely jealous.
we were looking at that the other night, the three of us, and we were just like, wow.
Move over there, yeah.
Yeah, if we ever go on holiday and we're in that neck of the woods,
definitely
knocking on that guy's door and saying, "Hello, we're living with you now."
Just ignore this chloroform rag and the massive moving van that we've brought with us.
What else have I got down here? I mentioned the film sequences looking so good. We've already talked about that. That brilliant line with Pat Troughton, where the Brigadier introduces Crichton as his replacement.
Yeah.
And Pat says, yes, mine was pretty unpromising too. Great stuff.
Fabulous.
The terrible Zodin gets her first mention here.
I know. Is Zodin in the, you know, the wider pantheon of Doctor Who villains, is Zodin, in my mind, is kind of up there with like this big celestial kind of being like as bad as the Master and as sort of like as powerful as Sutekh or whatever.
Yeah, I think so.
So what is Odin's deal? What is Odin's deal? Because I've not read or listened to anything that she's in.
I don't know if she's in anything.
Is she not in a comic or something? Or let me have a look.
I don't know. Have a look. See what you can find. I'll see what else I've got in the meantime. Where was John Pertwee going in Bessie?
To the hairdressers.
He was off to the hairdressers. I was going to say he'd just come back from dogging, but fine.
What the fuck? Oh my God.
Right, Sarah Jane Smith. She must have been pissed or something. I reckon Sarah Jane Smith pulled an all-nighter before this story. Because she leaves the house. We didn't even mention K-9. K-9's in this.
Oh, yeah, K-9 Mark III, yeah.
K-9's in this. Do not go out. So she leaves and goes to wait for the bus to go to work, right?
Yes.
And she sees this thing coming towards her. And she turns around, runs three paces into a fence.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh no.
She's been on the... Look, do you know what? It's hard being an investigative journalist. I'm sure that she, you know, all that stuff that was going on with the satanic cult, and the fact that... there is a line, which I think is really interesting and could warrant further examination, you know, in terms of Sarah Jane's mental state following... The Hand of Fear, because, you know, bollocks to Once and Future and Past Lives and Big Finish and all the sort of stuff that's happened subsequently, retroactively, including, you know, adventures with other doctors. But she's dropped off by the doctor and she goes about her normal life, you know, like, you know, between the Hand of Fear and, you know, ignoring K-9 and company, but Hand of Fear and the five doctors, she is just, she's never mentioned again. As far as we're concerned, she's gone back to being an investigative journalist. She's got the K-9 with her. But she says, when, you know, the doctor is involved and she goes, well, now I know you're making this up or whatever. And it's, you know, there's a denial thing going on there that the doctor would ever come back into her life, you know, because she has been abandoned by, you know, it was her decision to leave or whatever. But, well, no, it wasn't. It was the doctor saying, I can't take you home. So maybe there's something to look into there, because that line always struck me as like, well, why wouldn't it be the doctor? Surely... You know, I guess they haven't had any kind of interaction since, but, you know, or she is pissed and on the sauce, you know.
Yeah. Do you think that if we went inside her house, maybe when she shuts the door, you can just hear the bottles, empty bottles rattling.
Oh, my God. Well, she's got a lovely big house. So what else do you spend your time doing? Once you've put that investment down, you get drunk in it, you know?
Yeah. What else have we got here? Oh, I said about Susan. Imagine leaving Doctor Who because your part was shit and coming back and being given this crap.
I know. It must have been like, well, do you know what? This is my place in this show. Is to not be treated like this character is worth anything, because Susan isn't. Susan wasn't and still isn't. And so that must have been really shit, actually, for Carol Ann Ford, you know. Here's an opportunity for me to come back. You know, I'm casting aspersions here. I'm probably not being totally fair. But how much work had she got between Dalek Invasion of Earth and the Five Doctors? And then she comes back and, you know, I've still got glass ankles. You know, I'm still just twisting my ankle and falling over and, you know, falling over my grandfather or lusting after my grandfather, whatever it
was. Lusting after my grandfather. There's a bit in that scene with... where the Cybermen turn up.
Mm.
And that's all really weird, isn't it? Because Susan doesn't recognise the Master, which I guess you can forgive because he's regenerated. But you would assume that she has some idea of who he is.
Mm.
But that bit with the Cybermen, you know, they just sort of appear.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just there.
I'm getting a tea delivery, I think. Thank you, my love. It's all right. No, thank you very much. This is what I've moved to New Zealand for. It's tea on demand in my Doctor Who shed. Thank you very much, my darling.
The tea of Rassilon.
The tea of Rassilon is too hot. Go on. Sorry about that.
Yeah, but that all seems a bit weird, isn't it? Because no one notices this army of fucking blokes coming down the hill until they're there. They're like,
no, that's
Doctor,
right.
Look out, Cybermen. And like, but Peter Davison could easily see they're over there.
But, you know, that is the daftness of Doctor Who, isn't it? It's like, it's like a video game. It's like, unless you see the thing on screen, as soon as that sprite leaves the picture, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And maybe that's how it works in Doctor Who land. Maybe it's just until the metaphorical camera sees the monster coming over the hill, everybody is totally oblivious to it, like a horse with blinkers on.
Yeah, I think you're right. The only other thing, which I think is a missed opportunity, is that Colin Baker wasn't asked back to be Commander Maxwell. Because you've got the commander in it, in Colin's costume. Imagine having Colin in this as well, just as that part.
And it was because still called The Six Doctors. I mean, he probably wouldn't have got the part, though, because, you know, you think... And hang on, Ark of... Yeah, no, that is right. You know, okay, so this is after Ark of Infinity,
so Ark of Infinity has happened, because the Castellan comes back, doesn't he?
Castellan Kelner, killed. I mean, that would have been very interesting, but then he wouldn't have got the job because it would have been even closer to him eventually being offered the part.
But it would have been fun though, wouldn't it? Like if they,
if
he still got the part later on,
and
he got to be in this,
That would have been cool.
He would have been able to say he was in a multi-doctor story.
Two multi-doctor stories before he even got even got the part. That would have been neat. I mean, we haven't mentioned it yet, and I think people will probably be annoyed that we haven't mentioned it because it is a meme. Castellan and the mind probe, you know, it's just one of those moments in Doctor Who, isn't it? It's almost bigger than the episode that it's in. There's a helicopter coming over. Maybe I'm about to get mind probed. I mean, that delivery is just exquisite. You're an actor and you look at that line on the page and you go, how do I make this work?
How do I do that?
It's like Daniel Craig being given the die, Blofeld, die line in No Time to Die. It's like, right, how the fuck am I supposed to make this sound convincing? But I tell you what, he knocks it out of the park.
He manages it. He does. He manages it. Because, you know, I never... saw the issue with it growing up. I just thought, okay, not the mind probe.
I think the thing
is when you see the outtakes and you see him go, no, not the mind probe. Oh my god.
I think it's just that he kind of emphasizes the wrong words almost in the version they use. You know, that's why it's funny. No, not the mind probe. You know, it's an important moment in Doctor Who history. Apologies for this helicopter going over, by the way.
I mean, I can't hear anything.
Oh, excellent.
Better than the
cool.
anal probe, anyway.
Okay, we've got to the point of anal probing in our conversation. So is that the Five Doctors in a nutshell? Like, have we covered all our bases?
I think so. I don't think there's really much more we can add.
I think it's my favourite... you know, sort of top three, top five Doctor Who's. I think it's just...
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Wow, gosh.
Easy to please, you know. I put out on Twitter the other day, I am as basic as you get. Genesis, Earthshock, Five Doctors, Remembrance, you know, Tomb. They are so well regarded for a reason. I think the Five Doctors out of those is probably the one that people would over the most.
Yeah.
I understand that, but equally, I think it just gets everything right. I just think it hits all the it scratches all the itches. You know, it ticks all the boxes for me. Apart from, you know, maybe the way the Daleks are treated. But and because you didn't do it for the TV movie, number one in the UK, Uptown Girl by Billy Joel, and the highest grossing film of this year, Matt, 1983.
1983, Return of the Jedi?
Bang
or
on.
Last Crusade? Oh, yeah, Return of the
Jedi.
There
we go.
Nice.
So, shit, there you go. The Five Doctors. What do you guys think of it? Those who watched it on broadcast, You know, what are your memories of that whole, you know, frenzy in the lead up to the Five Doctors? Those of you that have, like myself and Matthew, grown up with it on VHS, either broadcast or special edition, you know, Mr. Whippy or Black Obelisk, you let us know. Black Obelisk is still in the lead, so, you know, that seems to be...
And where does it sit for people in terms of, like, top anniversary specials?
Ah, yeah. Where does it sit for you? You know, if we include...
Top.
Yeah, okay.
At the top.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does a better job of celebrating all of Doctor Who than, say, Day of the Doctor.
Yes, yeah.
Because the Day of the Doctor really specifically celebrates modern Doctor Who.
But then, to be fair to Day of the Doctor, it's got a lot more that it probably feels like it has to pay homage to. Whereas, you know, there's an extra 30 years that it's got to consider... including, whereas Doctor Who's only got...
Was off the air for a lot of that.
Nah, that is true. That is
16
true.
16 of those who weren't even on the telly.
But if we don't see Sam and we don't see, you know, all these other Doctor Who
Fritz
companions that popped up in the 90s and shit, then, you know, where's Grace?
Destry,
where's
Charlie?
Exactly, it's Charlie. Where are they all? You know, let's get those references in there if we can. Yeah, I what do you guys think? You know, for me, I think the Five Doctors is just... fantastic the way it is, but you know, we love to know what you think of all that stuff.
And it also has that wonderful outtake of John Pertwee saying, "Oh shit,"
in Bessie.
Yeah,
Bessie. I you know, when this eventually comes out, you know, maybe or maybe not this year, it would make sense. You'd imagine it probably is. Yeah. You know, maybe it's been announced by now. Who knows? When the collection set finally comes out, I want all of the studio outtake, and I think they will give it to us, won't they?
Yeah, probably. More likely.
I want all that stuff, and I will, even though we can't get them anymore because Universal have decided that Australasia and the Oceania region are not deserving of the Doctor Who collection sets anymore, I will be day one, as soon as that thing plops down on the doorstep, I will be watching all those actors, and I cannot wait to get more of the Five Doctors because, you know, like I said, it's an hour 40, but I still want more of it. And I think that is the highest praise you could probably lump on anything, any kind of episode or movie or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you heard it here, folks.
Heard it here?
You heard it here.
And you're not even on the Thatchers, because I'm not there.
I'm not even on the Thatchers. I'm just tired. What time is it? My God, it's 25 past nine. What time is it for you?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it is 25 past eight. So my day is about to begin, and it started in the best way possible.
Oh, the day is dawning on a Texas Sunday
morning.
Well, there we go. That was Five Doctors. Let us know what you think. Subscribe, like, share, tell your friends, tell your enemies.
Tell your sexy grandfathers.
Yeah, let us know what you think. And also let us know what you think about the new set and the setup and, you know, what can we do to make it better. I'm sure I'll put this in the edit and come up with a few ideas myself.
Same. You know, like, it's all a work in progress. It's all malleable. It's all going to, you know, we're just starting out. Maybe or maybe not. Have you seen the new opening title sequence by our David Burgess at the start of this episode?
Oh, yeah.
You can cut that if it's not in it. great work, or boo, late delivery. It's all coming together beautifully.
It looks amazing.
Want to keep the lights on, literally, if you want the podcast to continue, if you want the Review of Death in your life to go from fortnightly to weekly, then you might consider going over to the Patreon and supporting the Review of Death over there, because we're doing all the 60th anniversary stuff we can get our hands on, except Doomsday, because life is too short. We're currently going through the Once and Future.
I would sooner be assassinated by the world's deadliest assassin than
have to go through that. Same. And we're going to be doing lots of other cool things. We've got a bunch of audio adventures we're listening to. We've done Doctor Who and the Pescatons. Next up is The Ghosts of Endspace, and we're going to do lots of other cool things. Shakedown, Return of the Sontarans, is a commentary of that coming up. Loads of shit. So be part of the community, join the Discord, join the Patreon, and support your other favourite Doctor Who podcast.
Very good. Nicely done. What's next for us, Billy?
Oh, shit. I tell you what's next. It's an episode of Doctor Who that came from the season that I think you and I both went, get to fuck with this. It's not season 9, but it is the start of the rot setting in for us thinking, right, this is it. It is the season 8, series 8 classic, In the Forest of the Night. If it wasn't enough that season that they said abortion's wrong, this story also says don't take your meds, kids. So let's have fun with Frank Cottrell Boyce's only so far television Doctor Who script. Maybe there's a reason for that. Doctor Who in the Forest of the Night.
I wasn't on the Thatchers this week.
But I will be.
Boy, I'll be on it that one.
Jolly's going to have to drive you in next week because there's no way you're going to get through it.
I'm going to have to get on the gin. I'll see what they've got in the fridge.
There we go.
Well, yeah, look forward to that. Or don't. I'm not. But we'll see you then. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.